Spirit Radio Podcasts.
You know, a lot of people would see Brexit as a problem whose origins lie exclusively within the United Kingdom. It's a view that's regularly articulated by the Taoiseach and other members of the government, basically saying, like, this is the UK's problem, but obviously it's ours too. And our next guest sees Brexit in a very different way. He sees it as one symptom among many of problems that lie in the heart of the European Union itself. In other words, how did we get to this situation in the first place? He's outlined what these problems are in his new book, which he co-authored with Dr. Maurice Kinsella, and the book is called Troikonomics: Austerity, Autonomy and Existential Crisis in the European Union. And in studio to tell us more, we have its co-author, Professor Ray Kinsella. Morning, Ray. How are you?
Good morning, Mandy. Good to be here.
Okay, Troikonomics, what's it all about?
Troikonomics is a description of the economic and political imposition by the EU on what were regarded as bailout countries. It's a very distinctive form of austerity, and it goes way beyond the last of austerity. It reflects a mindset, and the mindset is all about control. It's something that's happened within the European Union that wasn't originally part of its vision and what it was about. And what that hegemonistic culture has done is to corrode the autonomy of member countries.
Is there some examples of ways that autonomy has been eroded?
Yeah, I mean, the one that we've talked about before, we do two case studies, one in Ireland and one in Greece. It's very interesting revisiting them. Greece continues to suffer really badly under what was regarded as a temporary adjustment process. If you visit Greece, you're aware of the hemorrhage of people. You're aware of the cuts in income, the cuts in household, particularly the burden of debt. When the EU celebrated the end of austerity in Greece, it was, in our view, a nonsense. It didn't happen that way. Really what we're trying to show is that this new form of hegemony, which we call Troikonomics, the economics of the Troika, is something that is deeply corrosive, and it reflects a much wider problem within the European Union itself. And until that's addressed, Wendy, we're looking at manifestations of this, including Brexit. One thing I would add is that it was a particular joy doing this book because I was doing it with my son, who's a real proper philosopher. So it's a synthesis of insights into what does autonomy mean? What does it mean to be a person? What does it mean to be a person, to be autonomous, to engage in the self-governance of your own future, your capacity to reflect, to determine what you want to be. And that means not being dependent. So whether it's a person or a family or a nation, collaboration is good, cooperation is good, but dependence is intrinsically negative.
Do you think we're dependent? Ireland, I mean, on
the EU. We are. What's happened in Ireland is that I think we've suffered from a memory lapse. What we went through less than 10 years ago was an existential crisis. It impacted on our image of ourselves, on our identity, and the future direction of Ireland. It's not clear that we've learned the lessons. When you look at social indices like affordability of housing, when you look at exclusion, and particularly when...
From an economic perspective, does that worry you? Because that has been a discussion, Ray, just in terms of, it feels like deja vu in many ways, certainly from a housing perspective, right? But what's different about 10 years ago is, as well as house prices rising, we've also got rent obviously just being so unaffordable in many places, but we have the threat of Brexit on top of that.
We do, and in a sense, both of them are manifestations of this this deeper crisis. Europe began with a really healthy vision that was described as community in different ways. Europe has achieved great things, but it has stopped reflecting. And when you stop reflecting and you begin the drift towards a federal empire, you go from community to empire, then bad things happen. And they happen in Germany, Wendy, when you see the post-war political consensus collapsing. They happen in France on the streets when people are forced out on the streets, as they were in Athens, not as populism, but because it's an expression of exclusion. And then you look at Brexit and you say, well, what's going down here?
What do you think? Do you think it is a kind of symptom of the type of EU you describe? I mean, at the same time, Ray, some politicians and people would feel, you know, this loss of autonomy, yeah, it's worth it for what the EU has done for us and what it gives us.
Well, there are two things there. Fact and truth is the key thing. What the EU has done for us, we have, as a nation, and rightly so, because we are part of Europe, we have more than paid our fair share. And we continue to now be, as it were, in surplus. But that's, it's not a matter of cost and benefit. We have contributed rightly to Europe, but we have become dependent on Europe. And again, I would say at any level, dependency is intrinsically bad. Cooperation is good. If you have a couple or if you have a family or you have a company, cooperation, as Morris would describe it, to become oneself amongst others, whether you're an individual or a country or a community, to become oneself among others, that's a good thing. What we're seeing in Europe is the opposite of that. We're seeing the suppression of the capacity to express oneself. And there are some responsibilities that are not transferable. The responsibility for the common good, that a parliament has a non-transferable responsibility to uphold all the country is and all that it's capable of. We don't see that in Ireland now. I mean, a narrow example would be fisheries, but it's not about pure economics. It's about, for example, our capacity to transform ourselves, yet again, as we have in the past, to reach out to the streets and include people. There's a kind
How
of,
does the EU hamper that?
Well, it's not clear to me that in both cases, what I see as really disturbing, what both of us would see in terms of philosophy and in terms of economics, is the exclusion of people from politics. Now, in Ireland, for example, one in three people, whatever view you take of social issues, there is a freezing out, an exile of a contrary view, which is based in faith and Christianity. That view is frozen out. And that's unhealthy because people don't have a democratic home to go to. In Europe, on the streets of Paris, we saw people who were excluded, who didn't have a political voice, and which in
and
the
that leads to people being disenfranchised then and
completely.
Do you think, in terms of just with Brexit as a backdrop, Professor Kinsella, is or have you been surprised at the lack of self-examination within the EU? Just kind of saying, okay, well, what were the causal factors to this?
That's the key. That is the key point, Wendy. That Brexit, we define as an effect of this deeper malaise rather than the cause of it. But that should have been an occasion where the EU reflected, well, what's happening here? Why do people feel the need to, quote, take back control? Why do they feel the need to be uncomfortable about where the EU is at? That never happened.
Why not?
Well, it didn't happen because there is a dynamic in Europe, which is about centralisation, where smaller countries are marginalised and countries like Eastern Europe that may have faith values that don't accommodate to a new secular regime are seen as inconvenient. The important point is, in all of our lives, and this is maybe a positive point, crises which we're seeing in Westminster and in Brussels and in Ireland, crises doesn't have to be a negative thing. It can be a catharsis for change. It can confront us with realities that we have the capacity to change, we need to change. That hasn't happened so far.
Do you think, Ray, you mentioned obviously some social issues and a lot of discussion certainly here in Ireland, that there does seem to be an almost ideological war, and where people really have to, there's a real polarisation in discussions on hot topics. And when it comes to the European Union, do you feel that you're just shut down? Because if you're just saying, let's just ask some questions here, let's just examine where the EU has come from, where it's going, you're just kind of slammed down as an anti-EU or a Eurosceptic, and people don't want to listen to you.
Well, really, isn't that the truth of it? That we prefer to use slogans and caricatures like populism and anti-EU or left-wing or right-wing. When you look at Greece, and we reconsidered it again, you're not talking left-wing or right-wing there. That consensus is broken down. You're talking about, in truth, existential angst, where people are desperately worried about their families, where people are worried about subdividing their home, where people are saying, we will never again be independent of this debt burden. So the EU hasn't reflected on that. What I would find deeply worrying is that if you're looking at the manifestations of this deeper malaise in Europe, of which Brexit is one, the most alarming for me is militarisation. Because after Brexit became a reality, the vote was cast, what did the EU do? Its big initiative was to found an EU army and to build up that.
So the PESCO agreement that Ireland signed up to, which there was very little debate or discussion on.
That's right. And there hasn't been a proper discussion on that. Think about it for a moment. Where did Europe ostensibly come from? Well, it came from the impact of war. Where is it heading back to?
Correct. Why are they setting up an army, I guess, is the question. Just finally to ask you, because Tarek's time, as always, when we have our chats, Professor Ray Kinsley is chatting to me today. Brexit is drawing closer. There's no deal in place. What's going to happen next, do you think?
There is an interregnum there now where Europe can step forward and say, this shouldn't be about a war, this should be about a democracy. Where Ireland can say, we will not play political games here about backstops. It's too important. We have a responsibility to work with the UK to come up with something that avoids impaling negotiations on a backstop that is a contrivance. It's catharsis again, Wendy, isn't it? It's making the right decision for the right reasons. We hope and pray that's going to happen.
Well, Professor Ray Kinsley, thank you so much for joining us on the programme this morning. And Professor Ray Kinsley has authored a book with Dr. Maurice Kinsella. It's called Troikonomics, Austerity, Autonomy and the Existential Crisis in the European Union. You can check it out online and also get it on Amazon as well. When it comes to our blood, do you know it is a very valuable and precious thing? It can't be manufactured, it doesn't have a substitute, and the only way it can be obtained, if you are in need of it, is through generous blood donations. And one blood donation can ultimately save a life. My husband last week was shipped off with lots of his colleagues to give blood. I was very proud of them all. And it's amazing to think of all the different places that blood will go in the next few weeks. So perhaps you've never given blood before and you want to just know about how you can do it and the criteria and all that sort of stuff. Or maybe you've given blood before and this will just be a reminder to make sure that you keep on doing it. On the line to tell us more is Stephen Cousins, who's the National Donor Services Manager for the Irish Blood Transfusion Services. Stephen, good morning to you.
Hi Wendy, how are you doing?
So tell us a little bit just about the current need for blood donations at the moment. How are we doing?
Well, we're probably at the moment, we're running just about under 7 days, which is normally, it's not a bad situation to be in. It's not particularly comfortable, but it's not too bad. But the catch is actually that we're going into Christmas week and the holiday period. And what that means is that normally where we would have collections every week on most days through Monday through to Friday, we can't do that next week. So we won't have any clinics on Monday, Tuesday or Wednesday of next week. So that's a major problem for us because we only ever hold, as I say, about 7 days' supply. So we've got to make sure that each week we maximise collections as much as possible. So over the whole Christmas period and even into New Year's. Again, we lose a few days into the New Year's as well.
So basically you need to try and build up a little bit of a surplus because of the Christmas season.
We do indeed, yeah. It's absolutely. And we've been trying to do that over the last number of weeks. We've had extra clinics around the country, and we have extra clinics this Sunday. And while we've had a good response to them, as soon as the blood comes in, it's going out the other side as well, because the hospitals are quite busy, actually, in the last few weeks. We've noticed that. So it has left us, I'd say, with 7 days, which is a wee bit shorter than where we'd like to be. And actually, where it comes down to particularly Stark is when you look at the individual blood groups. So, for example, O neg, which is the universal blood group, that's actually only at 4.4 days at the moment.
So explain that to me now. If I'm O negative, Stephen, does that mean my blood can be given to anybody?
Absolutely. And the problem we face is that of the whole population, about 8% of the population are O negative donors. But when we issue blood to hospitals each week, about 16% of the issues to the hospitals are O negative. So there's a mismatch there in terms of the amount of blood we need from O negative donors compared to what the hospitals need. So we're always looking for O negative donors.
So yeah, once you figure out, or if you know that that's your blood group, in a way it's probably even more important for you to try and give blood as often as you can, because it can be used for everybody.
Certainly, we would say all blood donors are absolutely vital to us, and there's very seldom a time when we'd say we don't need anybody's blood. But certainly O neg is that bit different again, because it's the universal blood group. It's also used in a couple of other different situations as well, particularly for very young children, toddlers and newborns. O negative in most cases can be the main blood group that's given to them.
In terms of then just the sort of criteria or things that you need to think about before you give blood, what makes you eligible?
Well, there's so much in it in terms of why people can or might not be able to give blood, that there are a number of, I suppose, key things. You might hear from my voice at the moment of a bit of a cold, and that is actually one of the main reasons why people can't give blood, is that if they're feeling unwell, what we say to them is until you've recovered from the cold, we would ask you not to come into the clinic.
So you have to be in full health, basically.
You do, really, yeah. It's sometimes we know it can frustrate donors a little bit when they feel things that aren't really that much of an issue for them. They're willing to come in and give blood, but the problem is that the blood has been given to a patient whose immune system could well be at zero, and something as minor as a small cold actually could cause an awful lot of trouble for that patient. So that's why we're very, very cautious in terms of criteria we apply. We probably have the safest blood in the world, so we are quite strict in the criteria, but there's good reason for that in terms of ensuring patients are well, and then there's some criteria as well that ensures the donor as well. But I suppose probably the main ones there, so the likes of not feeling well, a cold, that kind of stuff. People who've had a blood transfusion before, they can't give blood, and that's always, again, that's one of the more frustrating things, because in a lot of cases people only become aware of the need for blood donations when they receive it or a family member receives it, and they're usually the people who want to give it most after that, but they're unable to because they've received blood. But there's a number of other things as well. So I suppose where I'm from, up the toward the north of the country in Dundalk, people living there, if they've lived in Northern Ireland or the UK between 1980 and 1996 for over a year, they're ineligible to give blood in Ireland due to the possibility of variant CJD. So there's quite a number of reasons why people can't give. And really, probably the best thing that people can do is, if they're unsure, well, even if they're not unsure, what they should do is
double
on our
check,
website.
Yeah,
we've an eligibility quiz on our website. It's very quick. It only takes about a minute or two to do. And that kind of covers probably the main reasons why people might not be able to give blood. And then if you know of specific things that maybe maybe some medicine that you're on, again, you can look that up in our frequently asked questions part of it, and see, well, does that medicine exclude you from being able to give blood?
So in terms of the process, just even for someone who's never given blood before, how does it work?
Well, the first thing I'd say is before anybody comes in, is to make sure that they're well hydrated and they've eaten, because that can often be a problem on the night in terms of their iron levels, and also in terms of their veins being well enough to take a needle. So that's the first thing. So when people arrive in, they register, and we take their details, and we enter them into the system. And then I suppose the first thing that they notice then is we do a small pinprick at the top of the finger, and that's to measure hemoglobin levels within the body. And there's a certain level that your hemoglobin needs to be at. The hemoglobin is effectively, it's like measuring your iron levels. And there's a certain level that all donors need to reach to ensure that they're okay to give blood. So once they've past that, then they'll sit down with a nurse, and there's a detailed health and lifestyle questionnaire, and it just goes through a whole load of questions in terms of your health, in terms of your lifestyle, things like, you know, where you've been traveling to, because again, another reason why people might be able to get blood is if they've been in an area where it's a malarial area or there's other viruses in those areas, that sometimes that can mean that they're not able to give blood for maybe 4 months afterwards. So again, we go through all of that with the donor and question them, and providing all as well, then it's to the donation bed, and you kind of sit there, the needle is inserted, and people then, it's about somewhere between 7 and 10 minutes to give an actual pint of blood.
So fairly simple, really. Sitting down for 7 or 10 minutes and the blood that you give could save a life.
Oh, it's saving lives. It's helping people who are very unwell recover. A lot of people might realise, you know, for the likes of cancer, about 67% of blood that's issued is used in for cancer patients. So, you know, we everybody understands cancer. They you know, unfortunately, people always know someone who's had cancer. But for someone to recover from cancer, if there wasn't blood there, it wouldn't happen. In fact, the hospital services wouldn't work without the supply of blood being there, because they couldn't start operations, not knowing if there's sufficient blood there. So it's absolutely vital to all patients' recovery. And so no doubt when someone's coming in, and it can seem a bit funny because, you know, someone arrives into an ordinary community centre on a wet and windy night, and, you know, they could be there for, it could be a busy centre, and it could be, you know, 2 hours maybe giving blood. And you're kind of walking away going, well, you know, how does that feel? But actually what you've done is without doubt saved someone's life, and that is an incredible thing to achieve.
It really is. Well, Stephen, please God, with your additional clinics and the chat we've had today, that lots of people will be giving blood. And I know the best way for people to find out what clinic is near them and when is on your website, giveblood.ie. Thanks for joining us on the programme this morning. That's Stephen Cousins there, the National Donor Services Manager for the Irish Blood Transfusion Service. You know, as we think about the countdown to Christmas, the presents, the food, what about giving the gift of life by giving blood this Christmas? And that's what it's all about, isn't it? About being selfless, helping others, helping someone you might never even get to meet. That's pretty special to me. You can go to the website giveblood.ie. You can see where there is a donation clinic near you. Well, today, President Michael D. Higgins will officially sign abortion legislation into law. I imagine for many, not least the one third of people who voted against this legislation, and indeed for the many doctors, nurses, midwives, pharmacists and other medical professionals who voted both ways but have objections to this legislation, it's probably the worst Christmas present that they could have thought of. And more news was delivered today as we heard that clinical guidelines on abortion have been sent to GPs around the country. Now, the reason for this is that Minister for Health Simon Harris really wants to keep to his schedule of rolling out abortion services and what can be regarded as, I don't think it's hard to argue with, one of the most liberal abortion regimes in Europe by the 1st of January. But in this almost frenetic rush to railroad this legislation, is it really necessary? And as we've heard warnings from various obstetricians and other medical professionals, could it put women's health at risk? Our next guest has been issued the guidelines and has been looking at them and considering how it's going to impact him and his work as a GP. On the line, we have GP Dr. Andrew O'Regan. Andrew, good morning.
Good morning, Wendy, and good morning to your listeners.
So tell us a little bit about the guidelines and what's in them and what's kind of struck you about them.
Well, I've read the guidelines for the first time this morning. They arrived in my emails yesterday, Wendy. And the first thing that struck me is that if you just look objectively at this whole thing, we've got guidelines for a whole new procedure that's never been seen in Ireland before, coming out 12 days before the procedure is to become lawfully available. And in those 12 days, you have the Christmas break. So it just seems unrealistic. I was just thinking before coming on the phone to you, it's actually hard to believe it's happening in this way. To say it's rushed is an understatement. And I don't think you would a minister for health would do this for anything else, only that the subject of abortion is so politically driven. And that's a disappointment, to say the least.
From that perspective, and as you say, if you're trying to look back at it, look at it unemotionally for a second, but just from a kind of logistical perspective even, of just, okay, in 12 days' time, And then considering what this legislation means. So you're talking about, you know, for a woman, probably one of the most serious decisions that she will ever make. We are talking about the ending of a life. Is getting guidelines emailed to you, is that enough for a GP to be able to try to help that patient as best he or she can?
Well, I guess the quick answer to that is no. And I think the whole way this has been set up is it's not designed to help women. It's designed to get abortion available as quickly and as accessibly as possible. And I don't think, and I really mean this objectively, I don't think there is enough attention being given to safety in terms of things like complications that can come out of this. But before I go into the guidelines, I just want to point out something that's really important to remember. And that is that these abortions that we're talking about, these will be carried out on healthy babies with healthy mothers. There's no mention in the guidelines anywhere of seeking a medical indication that there might be something wrong with the health of the mother. That's not mentioned at all in the guidelines. It's all about getting the procedure done and getting it done as quickly as possible. So in my opinion, and in the opinion of many, many of my colleagues, this is not a healthcare issue. And again, I'd have to question the appropriateness of general practice for this. As I said to you before, when the GPs are going to be doing this, according to Minister Harris's plan, in local GP clinics. And this is a complete outlier. And if you look at what's happening in countries like Scandinavia, the UK, and almost any other European country, this is certainly not the way abortion is rolled out. It takes place in specialist clinics where nothing else really happens in those clinics other than abortion. So to put it into your local GP surgery is, one, an outlier, and two, it's something that I would be very uncomfortable with.
In terms of, Dr. O'Regan, just the training side of things, there was a story last week that Minister for Health Simon Harris had held the first training, and 60 GPs turned up of the whatever there is, 2,500 in the country. And obviously you yourself won't be providing abortion, but what about your colleagues? Do you think there's going to be much of an uptake?
Again, in short, no. You pointed out that there was only 60 GPs out of, you know, over 3,500 in the country turned up to this training day. I mean, I'm not coming on to stop those GPs doing what they want to do. But I think, I mean, if we consider all the other GPs in the country that are going to be facing this in the coming weeks, I'll be on my out-of-hours rota here in Kerry over the Christmas and over the New Year. And what I'm thinking of, if in those early couple of weeks in the New Year, if there's a complication as a result of an abortion, I certainly don't have training to deal with that. More than that, I don't have any knowledge made available to me on the pathways to secondary care. So what must be put in place and what has been put in place, I don't know, to deal with a woman who has had a complication as a result of these medical abortions. And there are complications. There's been a concerted effort to sort of to dress this procedure up and to call it safe. We all know that this isn't a safe procedure for an unborn baby, but it's not a safe procedure for a woman either. Heavy bleeding can occur, infection can occur, and in some cases rupture can occur, especially if there's an ectopic pregnancy. And if these are going to be performed without ultrasound, which is what's planned, then I, as an out-of-hours doctor, working maybe on New Year's Day or whatever, could be faced with the situation where a complication has occurred as a result of a medicine dispensed by one of my colleagues. And I'm unready for that at the moment.
Which is actually probably a point that some people haven't thought of. A woman goes to another GP that is providing a service, you're on call or whatever, and then what do you do? And that training isn't there. And obviously you just want to look after her as best you can, but you're not equipped to do that. What about conscientious objection, Dr. O'Regan? Is that catered for in the guidelines?
There is a mention of it early on in the guidelines, yes. Unfortunately, it's not satisfactory. You know, it doesn't. The guidelines don't really cater for people with a conscientious objection. And again, I'd like to remind listeners that despite the message that's been put out there, the majority of GPs actually will have a conscientious objection. to getting involved in this. It's not just about the practicalities. There is, it is a fact that the majority will not get involved because of reasons of conscience. And there is no clear guideline for us to help us, I suppose, deal with the situation and address the lady in front of us as best we can without having any involvement in it. And that's a massive failing on the part of these guidelines. If we're supposed to practice medicine, do the best for our patients, care for them as we've always done, we'd expect our college to very robustly set out guidelines that protect us. We will be looking to see what the medical council guidelines say about it, and of course those guidelines are not available as of yet either.
In terms of just a few of the things I wanted to pull out that I've seen from the guidelines, Dr. O'Regan, the 3-day waiting period still remains. And, I know the reason for that is to give a woman time to really think about this decision. But is there any advice given to GPs on that? In other words, during that time, are women offered any support, any alternatives, or are you just kind of told to say, come back for an appointment in 3 days' time?
I mean, this is a huge source of disappointment. When I was reading the guidelines this morning, I came to section 2.2.1, and that section is entitled pre-termination counselling. So when the woman who's having a very challenging situation comes in to meet the GP for the first time about this, there's no proper guidance. There's no mention at all about exploring the reasons for the woman to request a termination. I think that's a huge omission. There's no encouragement for the GP to explore what supports that woman might have available to her, whether there are close friends, a mother, other family members available that could be brought into the situation. There's no encouragement for me as a GP to offer any alternatives, to discuss adoption, for example. None of that is mentioned. There's no mention at all of bringing in the woman's partner, even raising the issue, what does your partner think about this? Is there coercion involved here?
And that's an important point, especially when you consider the amendment looking at, that basically a child essentially can have an abortion without consent of their parents. So if you have a situation where it's a 14 or 15-year-old and they are pregnant, what were the circumstances surrounding that happening in the first place?
Again, I think it's because of the rushed nature of what's going on here that it really, really seems to be politically driven. Often in a situation where somebody is really under a lot of pressure and under duress, there can be coercion involved. So somebody that's not in front of the doctor could be forcing this decision on the woman. And the guidelines are not giving any consideration to that. And one of the first things I would do when a woman comes to me, she's in a crisis, she's pregnant and it isn't planned, is I would ask about the environment and her own personal situation and whether this is really a decision that she wants or a decision maybe that somebody in her family or her partner wants. And in my own experience, and having discussed it with colleagues, if time can be taken to explore the circumstances and to explore what supports are there and to bring in just one other person in that lady's life into the situation, the whole outlook can change. And I have seen situations where people have come thinking that termination was the only way out and reconsidered and have gone on to have their babies. But these guidelines and this legislation is not set up to encourage that sort of positive outcome.
Finally, just to ask you, Dr. Andrew O'Regan, in terms of when you look ahead now to 2019 and January 2019, what impact do you think this abortion legislation is going to have on GPs across the country?
It's going to change the nature of our profession. It's going to create problems within practices where some GPs may want to get involved with abortion provision and other GPs in the practice don't want to get involved. There's no pathway for how that will be resolved. There's going to be a whole host of practical problems. But I think actually, Wendy, it's not about me as a GP. It's not about my colleagues. This is about the effect that it's going to have on women and on unborn babies and on the culture of our country. I think it's a really dark time. But at the same time, I think it is a time that gives all of us an opportunity. People can see the truth and the reality behind this. It gives us an opportunity to stand up for something and to stand up for something that's really important in a positive and in a loving way. And I want to appeal to your listeners to think about how they might do that. And I'll certainly be thinking about how I can do it in the new year.
Dr. Andrea Regan, thanks so much for joining us on Spirit Radio this morning. Right, it's time now for our Life in 5 interview. We talk to different people each week and we just chat to them about their life. And we ask them different questions. They pick from a list, they pick 5, and they tell us the answers to those questions, and we chat more about it, and they talk to us a bit about their faith as well. And in studio with us this morning, we have Peter Taylor. Peter, great to have you with us in studio today.
Yeah, great to be here.
We were just talking about the Christmas preparations, and I'm glad to see that there's you, like a lot of Spirit Radio listeners, you're just trying to keep it low-key.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, I know you're saying your wife's doing most of the cooking. Do you do chopping the vegetables, or what do you do?
No, she does most of it.
She's like my mom, who used to just like, get out of the kitchen, I'll handle it, I just want my space.
Yeah, well, she is heavily pregnant this time around, so maybe I should probably offer to help out with
With the chopping of the veg or foot rubs afterwards and lots of looking after. That's my advice.
Yeah, good advice.
So let's get to some of your questions today. So before we get to those questions, I should say, just tell us a bit about yourself.
Yeah, I am a assistant professor of theoretical physics in the School of Mathematical Sciences at DCU. So that's my background. So my research area is black hole physics. So I mostly
you got to plain English that one for us.
Yeah, so I mostly focus on trying to combine the two pillars of 20th century physics, which is Einstein's theory of general relativity and quantum mechanics. So stuff that describes things on large scales, that's relativity or gravity, like how the Earth orbits the Sun. And then stuff on really small scales, like subatomic particles and the kinds of experiments they do at CERN, where they fire beams of protons at each other at immense energies. So those two theories are fundamentally incompatible. But one of the areas where both of those theories are important are black holes. So these are these regions of space-time where gravity is so strong that not even light can escape. And so I tried to understand both of these two theories in
putting
the context
them together,
of black
which
holes.
Is incredible when you think of your area of expertise and the area that you're working in, because I think, probably wrongly, a lot of people would think when it comes to the sciences, especially things like theoretical physics, the universe, how it all works and trying to figure out how it all works, there's a misunderstanding that science and faith are in conflict,
yeah.
Which might lead us to your first question, God and how he helps you in your work. Do you feel that your work is in conflict with your faith?
No, I think that's an absolute false dichotomy. For me, the two go hand in hand. I think part of it is a media misconception, maybe. There are plenty of really great theoretical physicists who approach their work from an atheistic perspective, but there's also a lot of great theoretical physicists who approach it from a completely theistic perspective. And in fact, more of the Nobel Prize winners in physics actually are believers than non-believers. I think it's probably something like 60 to 40. I think it's a false dichotomy. For me, the two go hand in hand.
So in your day-to-day work, how does God kind of influence you?
You know, the obvious one is he actually gave me the faculty to study these things. So the opening note of my PhD thesis is a note thanking God for the faculty to uncover a page of the Maker's Blueprint. And that's...
Which is a really amazing way of looking at the universe.
Yeah. And that is how I look at it. And I consider it a privilege. When I think of these things, when I approach these things... It's nice to actually have a broader and bigger context for it, and I like the idea that that's exactly what I'm doing, that I'm uncovering a page of
God's blueprint, as you say, and how intricate it is, and are you just looking at it as you study more and learn more and teach more? Do you feel this is a hugely intelligent designer here? I call him God.
Yeah. I mean, I marvel at it, to be honest. I mean, I marvel at how finely tuned the universe is, how incredibly made it is, And for me, the more I study it, the more I marvel at it. And I think if you go back, if you there's also this kind of false dichotomy that, or this false perception that the more we've learned about science, the more we have figured out that we didn't really need God in the picture, and you know, this kind of narrative. But there's also this element that the more we've actually figured out, the more we've learned that things were way more complex than we ever imagined. I mean, this is true about biological systems as
well. Yeah, there's something like the molecular complexity in my fingernail I can't even fathom.
Yeah,
you know?
I mean, if you go back to somebody like Darwin, I mean, he really believed that, that cells were very simple. And most people did back then. They believed cells were fairly simple objects. But the more we've learned about these things, the more we've figured out that they are big factories, essentially, with really complex machinery going on. Very, very intricate indeed. And I don't think people imagined that back then.
What do your students make of you, Peter? I know when I was studying journalism, I was sometimes like a lone ranger, being the kind of one in the class who would often challenge lecturers on things that they said about faith and stuff. And as we talked about already, just how there's a lot of people in your profession, you know, in the area of physics that have a faith. But do you think students feel pressure to say, I don't believe in God, when they're studying theoretical physics?
Well, it's a kind of a funny one for me because I don't get a chance to teach too many theoretical physics students. I mostly teach mathematics.
Just maths, yeah.
And the, I guess, faith issues don't really come up too often. I mean, one of the things I do try to teach my students in at least one of my modules is how do we establish truth claims? And that's a really fascinating
topic. So it's like a theorem, really?
Yeah, so how do we establish truth? What is truth? And that's an interesting philosophical and mathematical question that you really can study, and it has a really interesting history, that question. One of the modules I teach is geometry, and I kind of use geometry as a tool to ask the question, what is truth? What does it mean to say that Pythagoras' theorem is true, for example? And what assumptions is that truth built on? And that's kind of an interesting way to approach these kind of subjects, because there are so many assumptions that even go into mathematical truths. We call them axioms in mathematics. And as well as axioms, you also have to start with a bunch of terms that aren't even definable. So I find the kind of philosophy of that interesting, because it applies to more broader things than just mathematics.
And also great to see just the level of critical thinking going on, which is sometimes lacking in many areas of Irish society at the moment. Okay, right. we got to get on to question two. I'm having too much chat with you today, Peter.
Yeah.
Question two is, a time you heard something clear from God.
Oh yeah, that's a good question. I could probably talk about several profound ways in which I feel like I've heard from God, but I thought, given the season, I'd go for something a bit more trivial and frivolous. When I just first got married, I was driving in the car with my wife, and we were actually having an argument over Christmas. Now, she's a Christmas fanatic. Like, she is all in for Christmas. She loves all the pomp and ceremony and the
decorating
the tree.
And
I'm a mathematician, so I'm a bit too pragmatic for that kind of stuff. So
don't fall into that stereotype. I'll put a Santa hat on you before you leave here.
Yeah. So, you know, she was actually getting quite upset because she was, you know, we were just recently married. She was like, how's Christmas going to work if I love Christmas and you're like the Grinch over there? And I could see her getting more and more upset as we were having this argument in the car. So, you know, I did the good thing and I kind of stopped for a while, and I kind of was driving along and I kind of felt myself kind of pausing and going, God, am I right? Am I right about this? I feel like I'm right about this. And almost as soon as I had the question out, straight away I heard, it's good to remember. And, you know, I don't know if it was my thought or if it was a God-inspired thought or if it was a directly from God thought, whatever way you want to contextualize it. It stuck with me to this day, this idea that it's good to remember. And so I almost immediately apologized to my wife and said, no, I think you're right. It actually is good to remember. I think if you look back even through the Old Testament, for example, you see God instituting Israel to remember various things that he did, because he seemed to understand the importance that of instituting ceremonies that involve people remembering something good. And when we fail to do this, we can kind of lose sight of really important things.
And probably having two small kids has helped you get rid of that grinchy nature.
Yes, to some extent. But I do often come back to this idea that it's good to remember, because I slip into cynicism quite easily. And part of it is just my training in being skeptical. And that's kind of what physicists are trained to do in a very formal way.
Interesting. I'm thinking of another physicist in my life. I'm looking forward to telling about this interview. Where do you see God just in everyday life, Peter?
Well, the obvious answer is my kids, of course. And well, I'd say more broadly in relationships, I would say, is a big thing. I think when you become a parent, you quickly marvel at how God perfectly balances discipline and mercy, because that's a real hard thing to balance as a parent. And you know, you have all this love for your children, and you kind of want to lavish things on them, and you want to be generous with them.
And the big eyes are looking up at you, or the one tear rolls down the cheek.
Exactly.
It's very difficult. Yeah.
But then at the same time, you have to recognize that there's a bigger long-term goal here that you're trying to achieve with your children, and that discipline is really important. So sometimes I marvel at the perfection of how God balances mercy and discipline, or you know, just justice and grace and all of these things, that it seems to be an infinitely precise tightrope walk. But that's one area I think that I
yeah, and I think you're right. As a when you are a parent, it helps you to at least try and understand that you can understand trying our best. Obviously, we don't do half a good a job as God, but we try our best to do that.
We
balance.
Aspire.
Yeah, we aspire to do that. Have you ever seen a miracle?
Oh, good one. Yeah, I believe I have. You know, it's always hard to talk about these things in Western culture, I think, because we're already philosophically predisposed to not believing in
these
things.
And you've already said you're a skeptic.
And I'm a skeptic a skeptic is just asking questions, right? And trying to review things critically. Okay, so I have this story that I will tell you. So my sister's Katie Taylor, the famous boxer. We were away at a world championships in Barbados, myself, my wife, my parents and Katie. And she had already had a couple of bouts and won a couple of bouts. And I think she was into the quarters or the semifinals of the World Championships. I think this was her third.
The pressure was really on then. Yeah.
The pressure was on. I think this was her third World Championships. I think she was going into the quarters. It might have been the semis. I can't remember that exactly. But she'd badly injured her hand going in her previous fight. And nobody had known about it yet. She was trying to keep it on the low key.
She didn't want to worry you.
Yeah, she didn't want the medics knowing, because they would have pulled
her
out.
They wouldn't have let her box then.
Yeah. Yeah. Now we had a real deep suspicion that it was broken. She had zero movement in her wrist. So she was sitting on the bed. My dad was secretly preparing to take her to the hospital to get it x-rayed, but without any of the judges or officials knowing. And in the meantime, my mum rang me and my wife and said, look, it looks like Katie's hand is probably broken. She's probably going to have to pull out. They're trying to get her to the hospital secretly. But maybe can you guys just pray? So I think we were down on the beach or something like that. Well, we were in Barbados after all. So we went back to the hotel room, got on our knees and prayed. And we were, you know, praying for about 5 minutes. And In while we were still praying, my mum rang us back and said, were you guys praying? And we said, yeah. And she said, it's okay. And we were like, what do you mean it's okay? And she said, it's fine. For she was sitting on the bed. My dad heard a click, and all of a sudden she was able to move it, like,
wow,
completely out of the blue. So she was sitting on the bed with no movement, and then something clicked and she was able to move it completely freely. Went on, won the World Championships in Barbados. That was her third title. So, you know, I perceive that to be a miracle.
It's an incredible story, but it also must have been a moment. And I'm sure you've had many, whether it's as a brother, a dad, or a husband, where just that gift of being able to pray for someone that you love and care about, even if it's just when they're just having a really difficult time, or in that situation, obviously a highly pressurized situation where you were, you know, praying for a miracle. It's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, that's what we consider our role being for Katie. We tend to travel with her as much as we can and just go over and pray with her before each fight. And yeah, it's an absolute privilege to do that.
Your next question then, and your final one, Peter, is how does God help you in your marriage?
Oh, I can almost hear my wife laughing. Yeah, this is another interesting one, because I remember being quite frustrated as an early Christian when I got married that people weren't as excited about marriage as I would have liked them to have been. And I think much of the marital advice that I received from people was, I think, quite detached from faith, actually. I think it was mostly secular advice. And this quote always kind of comes to mind, this Oscar Wilde quote, which was, the essence of romance is uncertainty. And I always disliked the quote, and I still dislike the quote. And I like his turn of phrase, though, and I prefer to say that the essence of romance is self-sacrifice. And I think that's much more meaningful. And I think also in that sense, Jesus is the most romantic person who's ever lived, because his whole life was self-sacrifice. And so I think there's a lot to learn from his self-sacrificial life.
And does faith help you do that? Does God help you do that? Because it certainly doesn't come naturally to me.
No, it doesn't come naturally, but I find once I've understood that I can at least look at the life of Jesus and look at how he lived self-sacrificially and go, okay, that's a standard that I can try to apply to my marriage. Whereas I found beforehand, most of the advice I got was really just kind of secular psychological advice. And, you know, I found it a bit fluffy. And I'm not a big fan of talking about things like love languages and the kinds of things that other people like to talk about. Again, probably my mathematician's hat on. I find that stuff, I don't know, I just find it a bit fluffy.
It's all in the selfless for you.
Yeah, I like being able to have a model that I can try to apply.
And Jesus is that model, as you say. And sadly, that message these days of being selfless, of putting your spouse first, is so countercultural. But you know what? It works. It's been lovely to have you as our Life in Five guest today. Peter Taylor has been chatting to us this morning. God bless you and your family this Christmas and the impending newest arrival, please God, in 2019 for yourself and your wife. Thanks so much for joining us on Spirit, Peter Taylor.
Thanks for having me.
There's been a lot of talk about pensions this year because there's been discussions about auto-enrollment coming from the government and all that sort of stuff. Now, I know that there's a lot of people listening that are probably like me, and you've been thinking about setting up a pension for quite some time. You've been talking about it, and then it stopped there and you haven't actually done it. And it can be difficult because it depends where you work. Sometimes if you're working, you know, in a big multinational company, pensions, they just happen. They're kind of an automatic thing. But if you're working for a small company, if you're working for yourself, then you may never have had a pension. So what is the point and how do you set one up? Especially when you're in a situation where you feel like, gosh, can I afford to actually put aside an extra few hundred from my net income into a pension fund each month? So in studio to help us with this, we've John McNicholas from Ethical Financial. Morning, John. How are
Hi,
you?
Hi, Wendy. How's it going?
Okay, you are a pension expert this morning. I had a chat recently with someone who was saying, do you know what? If you're 40 or under, you probably won't have a state pension. Because a lot of people, when they think of pensions, they say, well, sure, you have the state one. But do you think for a whole generation or two that we may not have a state pension to rely on?
No, I don't. I don't think that. I think it would be, the state pension will always be there, in my opinion. There will need to be changes along the way. So possibly PRSI rates will go up, or some kind of taxation will go up along the way. But no, I think if I was a politician, I would not get rid of the state pension. It would not be a popular move. And I think it's what most of us expect. So it's the expectation of citizens of Ireland that we will have some form of a state pension when we retire.
So for most people, the state pension isn't enough, though, to be able to sustain what they need. Obviously, you have to kind of sit down and work out what do I think I need. But then we're living longer.
Yeah,
I know we're working longer, but it could be 20, 30 years you need to survive on.
Oh, will be easily. Yeah, I mean, the expectation is for most for I won't say, we'll say the young, the word young loosely.
In but, a broad way, yeah.
Broad way. But look, the idea of people of our generation living to the age of 100 is conservative. The likelihood is people will live beyond the age of 100 over the next 50 or 60 years. So, yeah, look, I see pensions can be a bit tad boring and everyone switches off. And I understand that. I know it's my job, but I understand they're not boring. But the reality to the state pension is that if I round it up or to keep the math simple, when people go on to the state pension, you typically earn €1,000 a month, which is fine for most people to live on when you think about your bills and what you spend and your food shopping and the normal internet or mobiles, whatever our normal costs are. You don't have a lot of change left out of €1,000 in a month. So
that's really just pays for the necessities.
Yeah, in my yeah, exactly. That's right. And I mean, I typically like to try and enjoy life as best as I can. And likewise, retirement should be an enjoyable part of life, you know. And my experiences in life are that money, when you don't have enough of it, can be stressful. It can be stressful. And I suppose I've seen that in previous careers as a social worker as well. But not having money is stressful. So the idea of a pension is... Sorry.
Our human nature is probably, though, to kick the can down the road. You know, we just think absolutely. About what we need now. We can't even think of our future selves. But obviously, probably the Wendy in the future would thank Wendy now for setting up a pension.
Yeah.
So who should start looking at a pension? Should we all just be doing it?
Yeah, effectively, yeah. The short answer. I mean, everyone should look at it. Like, I met someone yesterday and they were talking about a pension and I said, look, the kind of current state of your finance at the moment, a pension probably is a bit unwise actually to start. So we'll put a plan in place. They just had a bit of short-term debt. And, and that is very common around Ireland because Ireland is expensive to live in. And I'm never judgmental to people when they say they don't save in a pension because I know how expensive it is. We all do. Pensions are for everyone, but the timing is specific. So really you should take advice from someone independent as to when is the right time, how much you can afford and help you make that decision. Because on your own, no one's going to do it. It's just not going to happen.
And that advice is important in terms of every family situation, every individual situation is different. And it could be a case of depending on their current financial situation, because you start at giving or contributing at one level and then that obviously can change over time.
Yes, it can. And I mean, like for a lot of people with the housing crisis, saving for a mortgage is a priority or saving for rent is a priority. So I am conscious of that. So it isn't a case that pensions are just a generic thing. Oh, everyone needs to save €500 a month. That's not practical for everyone. And it's not even advisable for everyone. But the I suppose the best thing this way to start with a pension is most of us will kick the can down the road until you're forced at some point. So my advice to people is just to try and rip the plaster off. Go and ring someone. Ring a financial broker. You can ring me. You can ring someone else who's independent. Preferably not directly to a bank or insurance company. Take an independent broker, and talk to them, and they'll tell you. And most of our job is to give advice to people. It's not to funnel them down a route saying you have to save this or this or this. It's to try and give.
You give financial advice rather than kind of peddling products.
Yes, correct. Yeah.
I don't mean that in a pejorative way, but as you say, if you're ringing a particular pension company, well, then that's their job.
Yeah, that's their job.
To do that.
Yeah.
Is it very okay? So I get in contact with you. We have a chat. You kind of figure out where I'm at. Is it complicated then to set it up?
No. The short answer: pensions aren't complicated to set up and get going at, and they're actually very flexible contracts, so people get worried sometimes that you're making a
lifelong commitment.
Yeah. It's not the case, you know. So if you for example set up a pension now for, we'll say small, let's say people, someone starts small at €100 a month, they can change that at any time. The ideal is that you increase that over time, but if circumstances change, you can stop that. They're very flexible contracts.
So you can pause your pension.
You can pause it, yeah. They're very flexible contracts. And they're not, I suppose they can be sold by fear. If I want, I can tell people, look, you're going to get old. You won't be able to work. You won't have money. You'll be, you know. But I think most of the financial advisors don't use that method anymore. They actually try and advise people And the
about what's best for them. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And the reality is, the pensions, they are flexible. They aren't lifelong. You're not locked in for the rest of your life to it.
And do you think people underestimate, John? I mean, even starting small is better than not starting at all. I mean, if you start a pension at 100 or 200 euros a month or whatever it is, if you're, you know, 30 something and you're doing that for 30 years, even if it just stays at that small amount, it's going to add up over time.
Well, absolutely, yeah. I mean, as a minimum target, I try and start with a minimum. And if you have for example, have 1,000 euro a month from estate when you're from estate pension when you're no longer working, even having a private pension of 500 euro a month extra makes all the difference in the world.
Because that's your discretionary income. You know, that's the difference between not being an extra few hundred euros a month, as I know many listening will know, can be the difference between being extremely stressed about paying bills or just even being able to go to the cinema or do simple things.
Yeah. And for a lot of people, if they have if they have grandchildren or if they have their own children, they do like to be able to buy, you know, birthday gifts and, you know, small things like that, you know. So I'm not talking about you need a pension to have holidays in Marbella every year for a
month. That would be nice.
It would be nice. And you can. and if you can afford it, great. But at the basic level, it's to try and just top up your income from your state pension.
How does it work from then your salary perspective? Does the money go into your pension gross or is it net? I.e., is it tax before it goes into the pension?
Yeah, so you get the good news to a pension is, but there's loads of good news. But one of the good news is that you get full tax relief on a pension. So if from your employer, if you put in 100 euro a month into your pension, usually for most people, the difference in your payslip every month will only be 60 euro. Because the government tax relief is factored into it.
It's so, free tax. Yeah,
100 euro goes into your pension, but you are 60 euro per month poorer for that 100 euro from your payslip. So, but really with pensions, this is more behavioural than it is financial. You know, most of us, when you start and you're now down 60 euro from month
you get used to it.
You get used to it and you forget about it. And the idea with pensions is just to take advice, start it and you'll forget about it and life will move on. You won't need to be. I'm not expecting people to think about their pensions every second week.
Yeah, but the interesting thing about just giving the example of 100 euro, and I know obviously it depends on the individual, and a lot of people will be able to give much more. And it depends on the company. Sometimes the company will match a percentage and all that sort of stuff. But take, for example, the budget, you know, from October, that's we're going to feel the effect of in January. I think it was something like the average person will get 50 euro extra a month. Mm. So there's 50 euro that you wouldn't have had before, you know, that you could think about it in that way. In terms of, I know that you can change the amount, you can pause it, all that sort of stuff. But what happens if you've decided, okay, I'm cashing in on this pension when I'm 65 or 66 or gosh only knows by the time I'm going to retirement age probably 75 by then, but let's say you've built up a lump sum and for whatever reason you need it before 65, are you able to get it? Do you pay big exit penalties?
No, you can. It depends on the reasons. For ill health, you can access your pension early. I mean, the reason the government give the tax incentive is that they do want people to have their own money when they get beyond the age of 60. So usually the minimum entry point to getting your pension back is 60. And you can get it at that point, no penalties to it. You can get it earlier than 60 in certain circumstances, but they do need to be genuine. You know, you can't get it back when you're 45 because you
want the extra
cash. No,
or whatever.
Sorry, yeah, it doesn't work that way.
Is there a difference then for people who are self-employed and employees if they're setting up a pension?
The principles are the same. So the principles are the same, but there are, I would say, probably more options, probably better options for people in who are self-employed or in small companies, because I suppose financial services, like everything, can be a bit complex, and there's loads of options. But for an advisor like me, for a company director or someone as a sole trader, there are good options with your pension. So I wouldn't see it as a negative that I'm not employed by a big multinational company. You know, I'm not going to have a good pension. The opposite is probably true. There's probably more scope in a small business.
And that you actually have more control. And I know one of the things that you do, John, is help people with kind of looking at ethical pension funds. Mm. You know, for example, if you don't want to be having your pension go into a company that deals in arms or something. I know the list is as long as the arm, but for many people listening, I know that would be important. And I suppose that's why it is important to get independent advice, because there's so many options out there. So you've given lots of us food for thought. I hope it's going on, listeners, 2019 New Year's resolution to set up that pension. Martin. I've been talking to John McNicholas from Ethical Financial. If you want to get in touch with John for some independent financial advice, you can get in touch via ethicalfinancial.org.
Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.